Kenyan President Ruto relents.
I concede. And therefore, I will not sign.
Plus, is North Korea headed to Ukraine?
Direct North Korean engineering support could free up Russian combat power for operations along the front line and contribute to Russian efforts to expand military infrastructure and defensive fortifications on the occupied territory of Ukraine.
And later, Iran intimidates journalists in other countries. And we look ahead to the first presidential debate of 2024 in Atlanta. Today is Thursday, June 27th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Armored vehicles rammed into the doors of Bolivia's government palace on Wednesday as President Luis Arce said the country faced what looks like an attempted coup. Arce called for democracy to be respected in a message on his X account. Hours later, he announced new heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force amid the roar of supporters. The new head of the army ordered soldiers back to their barracks, and soon after, troops and armored vehicles began pulling back from the presidential palace. For more, VOA's Scott Walterman spoke with Celia Mendoza of VOA's Latin American service.
So what do we know so far?
We know that members of the military that claimed that they were trying to free some political prisoners, especially members of the military, were able to break into Congress. They brought several military equipment, tanks were rolled through the streets of La Paz, which is the capital of Bolivia. According to the messages that were given by General Zuniga, who was leading the group, they were trying to restore democracy, according to the statements given to the media. And they claimed that they were going to do that during this event. However, things were stopped. The government was able to keep control. And just in the past few hours, General Zuniga and others were detained. However, mixed messages were given later in the evening when he was taken into custody. He also spoke to the media and claimed now that this was an order by President Arce, the president of Bolivia. According to him, this actually was planned on Sunday when they met at the school of La Salle, and the president said that he needed to do something because this week was going to be very difficult, according to the statements given by Zuniga. He said that the president said that they have to do a maneuver to bring down the military equipment and to do what is now being alleged to be a government order coup d'etat.
So if that's true, he sort of ratted them out right away.
Exactly. And that is now we have to see what it will be actually be proven to be truth. What we saw was the actions of the military, the statements that he gave initially claiming and going against President Arce, the political parties in the country, the President Evo Morales. This just adds to the confusion of the country of General Zuniga. He's able to talk to the media as he's being taken into custody.
Well, I mean, there has been a lot of unrest in the country.
Over the past few years, the economy of Bolivia, which was one of the fastest growing economically in the region, has stalled. They are going backwards in their food security, economy, poverty, and all those elements have contributed for people to start getting anxious and angry about the situation of the country. And therefore, this claim could be plausible. However, no evidence beyond his statements so far had been given.
Are people still out on the street?
As far as we know, people are now back into their homes. It is later in the night, so there's just a calm tension in the country.
Scott Walterman hosts International Edition here on The Voice of America. He was speaking with reporter Celia Mendoza of VOA's Latin American service. Meanwhile, Kenya's president said Wednesday that he would withdraw planned tax increases, bowing to pressure from protesters who had stormed parliament, launched demonstrations across the country, and threatened more action this week. Reuters' Christy Kilburn has more.
Kenya's President William Ruto backed down on planned tax hikes on Wednesday, bowing to pressure after deadly nationwide protests.
Listening keenly to the people of Kenya, who have said loudly that they want nothing to do with this Finance Bill 2024, I concede, and therefore I will not sign.
Ruto's backtracking will be seen as a major victory for a week-old youth-led protest movement that grew from online condemnations of tax increases into mass rallies. Demonstrators stormed parliament on Tuesday as protests were held across the country. Police opened fire on the crowds, who later broke into the assembly's compound just minutes after lawmakers had voted through the tax measure. Some demonstrators said on social media that despite Ruto's climb down, they would go ahead with a rally planned for Thursday, with many reiterating demands that he resign. Medics said violent clashes between police and protesters had left at least 23 people dead across the country and scores wounded. Edith Owino is a relative of a deceased protester.
It is very devastating because these are young kids. They were out to fight for their rights. I didn't see the reason for using the live bullets on them.
A Kenyan news outlet reported protests in at least 35 of Kenya's 47 counties. The unrest marks the most serious crisis of Ruto's two-year-old presidency, and the about-face may see off the immediate threat of more action. But it leaves him caught between the competing demands of his hard-pressed citizens and of lenders such as the IMF, which is urging the government to cut deficits to obtain more financing.
That's Christy Kilburn of Reuters reporting for us. Kenyan troops have also arrived in Haiti, where they're leading a peacekeeping force to help the government there maintain security and gain control from violent street gangs that have already displaced about 600,000 people. Haitians appear optimistic, but more than anything, eager for help.
If the Kenyan forces arrive in Haiti with the support of the Americans, I believe they will bring about a change. The people will support them, and the population recognizes the gangs in the ghettos. The population also has a duty to have their weapons, their machetes, and the fuel to go and fight the gangs too. I believe that they unload the Kenyan forces in Haiti is to provide a solution. If they don't provide a solution for the population will take action.
That's Ariel Kumer, a resident of Haiti. The Kenyan police are expected to be joined by officers from some 15 other nations, including other countries in Africa and the Caribbean, as well as Canada, France, Germany, Britain, and Spain. Altogether, the security forces will form a 2,500-strong peacekeeping mission funded primarily by the United States, which has pledged $360 million, though much of this has been held up by some lawmakers. It's a busy day for Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky as he meets with the EU in Brussels. Also, new reports coming out of Seoul that North Korea will soon send engineering and construction personnel into parts of occupied Ukrainian territory. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has more.
On Thursday, President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Brussels to participate in a European Council meeting and sign new security agreements. Zelensky held meetings with EU leaders and is scheduled to hold bilateral negotiations with EU member states. During the meeting with the President of the European Council, Charles Michel, two leaders discussed the start of negotiations on Ukraine's accession to the EU and further support for Ukraine. Zelensky signed security agreements with Lithuania and Estonia. He also signed a separate larger agreement with the EU, also signed by Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen. The document, entitled Joint Security Commitments between the European Union and Ukraine, is significantly different from the bilateral security agreements of Ukraine and NATO member states. The EU member states unanimously agreed to sign the treaty, which was a diplomatic success considering Hungary opposed it. One of the important norms mentioned in the agreement is that Ukraine will receive funding from the European Peace Facility, which is considered as a long-term support package. President Zelensky also addressed the Organization of American States, which unites 35 participants and supported the joint communique of the peace summit.
Thank you for your respecting the international law and the UN Charter.
In his address, Zelensky noted that there is not a single region in the world for which the rules violated by Russian aggression are unimportant. Everyone in the world wants safety from wars and deportations, from the destruction of cities and the abduction of children. Zelensky called to guarantee the security in unity.
It's about what should unite each and everyone in the world, every state and each leader who wants peace for their nations. Now, it is a special time for all of us, time when we will either fully restore the force of the international law, when treaties and conventions defining the rules for life of nations really work, or when there will be no rules at all. And only force will define everything, only violence of some against others.
Meanwhile, South Korean TV channel TV Chosun reported that North Korea will send military construction and engineering forces to take part in what they called restoration works in the occupied Donetsk region. TV Chosun, cited as South Korean governmental official, reported that South Korea expects North Korea to send a large-scale engineering force to the occupied Donetsk region as early as next month. While the Institute for the Study of War has noted that Russia appears to be seeking to build a coalition of friendly states with historically warm ties to the Soviet Union, including North Korea and Vietnam. Institute for the Study of War has not yet seen reports that North Korean military personnel intend to engage in hostilities in Ukraine, but direct North Korean engineering support could free up Russian combat power for operations along the front line and contribute to Russian efforts to expand military infrastructure and defensive fortifications on the occupied territory of Ukraine. The U.S. Department of Defense tells VOA, "We have been clear about our concerns regarding the deepening cooperation between Russia and North Korea for quite some time, including by sharing information publicly about how North Korea has enabled Russia's war against Ukraine through weapons transfer, including actions by Russia that would violate multiple UN Security Council resolutions, and will continue to make that clear and continue to work with our allies in the region to respond appropriately. It is something we take quite seriously." Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll take a look ahead at the first debate of the 2024 U.S. presidential election scheduled for Thursday night in Atlanta. First, though, as Tehran ramps up attacks on the diaspora news outlet called Iran International, lawyers are working with U.S. officials to better coordinate responses to a tactic known as transnational repression. Liam Scott reports.
Moving a 24/7 newsroom across an ocean nearly overnight is no easy task. But that's the situation the Washington-based team of Iran International found themselves in after a series of attacks on their London colleagues forced its British headquarters to temporarily close last year. Mehdi Parpanchi is executive editor of Iran International.
Their aim was to stop Iran International TV, and we couldn't let it happen. We had to do whatever we can to keep the channel on air.
Attacks against the broadcaster have been brash. Foiled assassination plots, a stabbing in London, and threats so serious that a reporter in Sweden moved to a safe house in June. Tehran is believed to be behind these incidents and more. Again, Parpanchi.
These kind of threats are increasing, unfortunately. And, Right now, it is mostly targeting Iran international journalists, but there is no reason to believe that it will stop there.
Tehran is one of dozens of governments that engage in tactics known as transnational repression to silence critics outside their borders. Keelan Gallagher, KC, is a barrister at London's Doughty Street Chambers, who specializes in human rights.
Iran for many years targeted journalists on its own soil, but what has started to develop into an industry on a huge scale in Iran has been transnational repression, targeting journalists outside the country, using the long arm of the state to try to silence journalists reporting.
Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs did not reply to VOA's email requesting comment. In Washington, the international legal team supporting Iran International is meeting with lawmakers, White House officials, and think tanks to raise awareness. A key issue, they say, is that governments tend to respond to attacks on their own. Mark Stevens is a partner at the London law firm Howard Kennedy.
And it's time that I think we catch up as states. We make sure that the governments are cooperating, that they're sharing knowledge.
For Iran international journalists, their families back home are also at risk of retaliation. Parpanchi says nearly all Iranian journalists he can think of have come under some form of pressure.
Threats can never become normal. No journalist should be subject to any kind of threats, specifically life-threatening threats.
Named after VOA Persian host Masih Alinejad, the United States already has a law imposing sanctions on those seeking to carry out Iran-backed attacks. But Gallagher is pressing lawmakers to take a more active role.
And were it not for brave journalists who, despite the risks, are telling us those stories, we simply wouldn't know what's happening within Iran. And that is something which should trouble every single American. And it's why we all must stand up for freedom of expression and for the right of journalists to do their job without fear.
While their lawyers look for long-term solutions to keep the team safe, Iran International's journalists continue their work broadcasting to audiences inside Iran. Liam Scott, VOA News.
U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump face off in their first debate of this election cycle on Thursday in Atlanta. VOA's Calla Yu tells us what to expect.
Donald Trump and Joe Biden enter their first debate of this campaign, with each telling voters that electing their opponent would be catastrophic. Trump says Biden is ruining the country.
Inflation is raging, crime is out of control. Europe is in chaos, the Middle East is exploding, Iran is emboldened, China is on the march, and this horrible, horrible president is dragging us toward World War III.
Biden says Trump would take the country backwards.
All progress, all freedom, all opportunities at risk. Trump is trying to make the country forget just how dark and unsettling things were when he was president. But we'll never forget.
Public opinion polling shows this is a close race, raising the stakes for this debate, says Northeastern University journalism professor Alan Schroeder.
I think that puts sort of equal pressure on both of the candidates, both in terms of the opportunity the debate presents to them, but also the risks.
This debate is unique in featuring both a sitting president and a former president, says University of Pennsylvania communications professor Kathleen Hall Jamieson.
So the public is more knowledgeable about both of these candidates as individuals, more likely to know about their temperament, their habits of mind, their disposition. But this year, because of the age of both, there is a need, even if you think you know a lot about both of the candidates, and you're more likely to this year, for you to be able to say, are they mentally acute enough to be president of the United States and mentally stable enough to be president of the United States?
Political debates are about message and moments, says political analyst Brett O'Donnell.
You've got to drive a message consistently across the debate, but then you want to have a couple of moments in the debate that are the shiny object, so to speak, that the press will pay attention to and that allow you to exercise competitive advantage.
This will be the earliest presidential debate in U.S. history, with neither Trump nor Biden officially nominated as his party's candidate. There will be no opening statements Thursday night. Both candidates will have their microphones muted when it's not their turn to speak. Calla Yu, VOA News, Atlanta.
And as we just heard, the U.S. is preparing for an election in November. There are upcoming elections in Britain and France. India, the most populous democracy, just wrapped up its election, as did the EU. Democracy, it seems, is pretty healthy. But often, things are not what they seem. A new poll by the Pew Research Center shows that support for representative democracy is actually declining. For more, I spoke with Richard Weick. He's the director of Global Attitudes Research at Pew.
Yeah, so when we conduct our international surveys around the world, we've seen that people say representative democracy is a good way to govern their country. But what we also see is that increasingly they're frustrated with the way democracy is working. So we just completed a 31-country survey, and across those 31 countries, 54% of the people we talked to are dissatisfied with the functioning of their democracy. And in a number of countries, it's been on the rise in recent years. So there are 12 countries that we survey pretty consistently. These are high-income nations. And if you look at those countries, over the last 3 years, we've seen a significant increase in people telling us they're dissatisfied with the way their democracy is working.
Now, does that mean they're simply dissatisfied with the results of the last election, or they are dissatisfied with democracy as a way of doing things? How can you tell that difference?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it doesn't mean they're necessarily rejecting democracy as a way to govern, and they still value democracy. And I don't think it's necessarily just a reaction to the most recent election, although that certainly could be part of the story. I think a lot of things influence how people feel about the way democracy is working. Certainly some of it's the economy. You know, you see a strong correlation between views about the economy and views about the way democracy is working. And in some places it can be, you know, those kind of social and cultural divisions in society that make people think democracy's not working the way it should. And often I think it's really about politics itself, specifically about representation and the way representation's working. And what we've seen in our data is that big majorities in just about every country we survey tell us that they don't think elected officials care what citizens like them think. They tell us quite often there's no political party out there that really represents my views. So, you know, it's a lot of things that influence how people think about the way democracy is working. But, you know, part of it is the functioning of democracy itself. They don't always think there's the link between citizens and their elected leaders that should be there. It's not as strong as it should be, and that leads people to be more negative about the functioning of democracy.
Did your study parse out the opinions by belief? So more conservatives are happy with democracy than liberals are, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that varies a lot from country to country. You don't necessarily see, you know, clear patterns on who's happy or not happy with democracy. I mean, certainly, you know, regardless of whether you're on the left or the right, if you support the governing party in a country, you're more likely to say that democracy is working well. So that's, you know, a pretty not surprising, but, you know, constant finding that we see across countries.
And getting back to representation, your study also found that people might be happier with democracy if certain kinds of people ran for and held office. I found that interesting.
What we see is that there's a lot of interest in having more women elected to public office, electing more young people, and electing more people from poor backgrounds. Now, you know, it varies a little bit from country to country. It can vary along ideological lines. But broadly speaking, there's a lot of interest, particularly in electing more people with those kind of backgrounds to public office. People say that would actually help policies in our country.
Richard Weick is the director of Global Attitudes Research at the Pew Research Center. Mr. Weick, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.